expression that left room for folly. Blue tipped her head back, staring up at the stars. It was strange to imagine how quickly they wheeled across the sky, a vast movement too far away for her to detect. Leo, Leo Minor, Orion's belt. If she had been her mother, or her aunts, or her cousins, scrying up through the heavens, would she see what she ought to say to Adam? She asked, "Are you coming back to Nino's?" "Am I invited?" She smiled in reply. It felt like a very dangerous thing, that smile, like something Mora wouldn't be pleased with. Blue had two rules. Stay away from boys because they're trouble, and stay away from Raven boys because they were bastards. But those rules didn't seem to apply to Adam. Fumbling in her pocket, she pulled out a tissue and wrote her name and the phone number for 300 Fox Way on it. Heart thumping, she folded it up and handed it to him. Adam said only, "I'm glad I came back." Turning his long self around, he began to push his dolefully squeaking bike back the way he'd come. Blue pressed her fingers to her face. "I gave a boy my number. I gave a Raven boy my number." Hugging her arms around herself, she imagined a future argument with her mother. "Giving someone your number doesn't mean you're going to kiss him." Blue jumped when the rear door of the restaurant cracked open. But it was only Donnie, his expression clearing when he saw her. In his hand was a tantalizingly fat, leather-bound book that Blue knew instantly. She'd seen it in President Cellphone's hands. Donnie asked, "Do you know who left this behind? Is it yours?" Meeting him halfway across the lot, Blue accepted the journal and flipped it open. The journal didn't immediately choose a page to open to. It was so well-worn and well-stuffed that every page claimed seniority. It finally split down the middle, obeying gravity instead of use. The page it opened to was a mishmash of yellowed clippings from books and newspapers. Red pen underlined a few phrases, added commentary in the margins. "Luray Caverns count as spiritual place? Crows equal ravens?" And jotted a neatly boxed list titled "Welsh-influenced place names near Henrietta." Blue recognized most of the towns listed. Welsh Hills, Glen Bower, Harlech, Mackinlith.
"I didn't really read it," Donnie said. "I just wanted to see if there's a name in there to return it. But then I saw that it was, well, it's your stuff."
By this he meant it was what he expected of a psychic's daughter. "I think I know who it belongs to," Blue said. She had no immediate thought other than wanting to spend more time flipping through its pages. "I'll take it." After Donnie had returned inside the restaurant, she flipped the journal back open. Now she had time to marvel at the sheer density of it. Even if the content hadn't immediately caught her, the feel of the thing would have. There were so many of the clippings she'd noticed before that the journal wouldn't stay book-shaped unless tied shut with leather wrappings. Pages and pages were devoted to these ripped and scissored excerpts, and there was an undeniable tactile pleasure to browsing. Blue ran her fingers over the varied surfaces, creamy, thick artist paper with a slender, elegant font. Thin browning paper with spidery serif. Slick, utilitarian, white stock with an artless modern type. Ragged-edged newspaper in a brittle shade of yellow. Then there were the notes, made with a half-dozen different pens and markers, but all in the same businesslike hand. They circled and pointed and underlined very urgently. They made bulleted lists and eager exclamation points in the margins. They contradicted one another and referred to one another in third person. Lines became cross-hatching, became doodles of mountains, became squirrely tire tracks behind fast-looking cars. It took her a while to make sense of what the journal was really about. It was organized into rough sections, but it was clear that whoever had created it had run out of space in some and begun anew later in the journal. There was a section on ley lines, invisible energy lines that connected spiritual places. There was a section on Owain Glyndwr, the Raven King. There was a section about legends of sleeping knights who waited beneath mountains for discovery and new life. There was a section of strange stories about sacrificed kings and ancient water goddesses and all of the old things that ravens represented. More than anything, the journal wanted. It wanted more than it could hold, more than words could describe, more than diagrams could illustrate. Longing burst from the pages, in every frantic line, in every hectic sketch, in every dark-printed definition. There was something pained and melancholy about it. A familiar shape stood out from the rest of the doodles. Three intersecting lines, a long beaked triangle. It was the same shape Neve had drawn in the churchyard dust. The same shape her mother had drawn in the steamed shower door. Blue flattened the page to get a better look. This section was on ley lines, mystical energy roads that connect spiritual places. Throughout the journal, the writer had doodled the three lines again and again, along with a sickly-looking Stonehenge, strangely elongated horses, and a labeled sketch of a burial mound. There was no explanation of the symbol. It couldn't be a coincidence. There was no way this journal could possibly belong to that presidential raven boy. Someone must have given it to him. Maybe, she thought, it's Adams. He gave her the same sensation as the journal did, the sense of magic, of possibility, of anxious danger. That same feeling as when Neve had said that a spirit touched her hair. Blue thought, I wish you had been Gansey. But as soon as she thought it, she knew it wasn't true, because whoever Gansey was, he didn't have long to live.
9. Gansey woke in the night to find the moon full on his face and his phone ringing. He fumbled for where it was nestled in the blankets beside him. Blind without his glasses or contacts, he had to hold the screen an inch from his eyes to read the caller ID. Mallory, R. Now Gansey understood the bizarre timing of the call. Dr. Roger Mallory lived in Sussex, a 5-hour time difference from Henrietta. Midnight in Virginia was 5 in the morning for Mallory the early riser. Mallory was one of the prime authorities on British ley lines. He was either 80 or 100 or 200 years old and had written 3 books on the subject, all classics in the very limited field. They'd met the summer Gansey was splitting his time between Wales and London. Mallory had been the first one to take 15-year-old Gansey seriously, a favor for which Gansey would not soon stop being grateful for.
Gansey, Mallory said warmly, knowing better than to call him by his Christian name. Without further preamble, Mallory launched into a one-sided conversation about the weather, the Historical Society's past 4 meetings, and how frustrating his neighbor with the collie was. Gansey understood about 3/4 of the monologue. After living in the UK for nearly a year, Gansey was good with accents, but Mallory's was often difficult due to a combination of slurring, chewing, extreme age, bad breeding, and a poor phone connection. Getting out of bed to crouch beside his model of Henrietta, Gansey half-listened for a polite 12 minutes before breaking in gently, "It's nice of you to call."
"I found a very interesting textual source," Mallory said.
There was a sound like he was either chewing or wrapping something in cellophane. Gansey had seen his flat, and it was quite possible he was doing both.
"Who suggested that the ley lines are dormant, sleeping. Sound familiar?"
"Like Glendower. So what does that mean?"
"Might explain why they're so hard to douse. If they're still present but not active, the energy would be very faint and irregular. In Surrey, I was following a line with this fellow. 14 miles, rotten weather, raindrops like turnips, and then it just disappeared."
Retrieving a tube of glue and some cardboard shingles, Gansey used the strong moonlight to work on a roof while Mallory went on about rain. He asked, "Did your source say anything about waking the ley lines up? If Glendower can be woken, the ley lines could be too, right?"
"That's the thought."
"But all it takes to wake Glendower is discovery. People have been walking all over the ley lines.
Oh, no, Mr. Gansey, that's where you're mistaken. The spirit roads are underground. Even if they weren't always, they're now covered by meters of dirt accumulated over the centuries, Mallory said. No one's really touched them for hundreds of years. You and I, we don't walk the lines. We just follow the echoes.
Gansey recalled how the trail had seemed to come and go for no reason while he and Adam dowsed the lines. Mallory's theory had a ring of plausibility, and really that was all he needed. He wanted nothing more than to start scouring his books for further support for this new idea, school day be damned. He felt a rare stab of resentment at being a teen, being tied to Aglenby. Maybe this was how Ronan felt all the time. Okay, so we go to them underground. Caves, maybe?
Oh, caves are dreadful things, Mallory replied. Do you know how many people die in caves every year?
Gansey replied that he was sure he didn't.
Thousands, Mallory assured him. They are like elephant graveyards. Much better to stay above ground. Spelunking is more dangerous than motorcycle racing. No, this source was all about ritual way to wake the spirit roads from the surface, letting the ley line know of your presence. You'd do a symbolic laying of hands on the energy there in Mariana.
Henrietta.
Texas.
Whenever Gansey talked to British people about America, they always seemed to think he meant Texas. He said, Virginia.
Right, agreed Mallory warmly.
Think how easy it would be to follow that spirit road to Glendower if it's shouting loud instead of whispering. You find it, perform the ritual, follow it to your king.
When Mallory said it, it sounded inevitable. Follow it to your king. Gansey closed his eyes to calm his pulse. He saw a dimly gray image of a king in repose, hands folded on his chest, a sword by his right side, a cup by his left. This slumbering figure was dizzyingly important to Gansey in a way that he couldn't begin to understand or shape. It was something more, something bigger, something that mattered, something without a price tag, something earned.
Now, the text was not quite clear on how to perform the ritual,
Mallory admitted. He rambled about the vagaries of historical documents, and Gansey only paid a little attention until he finished with,
I'm going to try it on the Lockyer Road. I'll let you know how it goes.
Brilliant, Gansey said. I can't say thanks enough.
Give my regards to your mother.
I will.
You're lucky you still have your mother at your age. When I was about your age, my mother was murdered by the British healthcare system. She was perfectly fine until she was admitted after a little cough.
Gansey half listened to Mallory's oft-repeated story of the government's failure to cure his mother's throat cancer. Mallory sounded quite cheerful by the time the phone had gone silent. Now Gansey felt infected by the chase. He needed to talk to someone before the unfinished feeling of the quest ate him from the inside out. Adam would be the best, but the odds were good that Ronan, who swung wildly between insomnia and hypersomnia, would be awake. He'd only made it halfway to Ronan's room before the thought struck him that it was empty. Standing in the dark doorway, Gansey whispered Ronan's name, and then, when that got no response, spoke it aloud. Ronan's room was not to be broached, but Gansey did it anyway. Putting his hand on the bed, he found it unmade and cool, the blankets thrown aside with the speed of Ronan's going. Gansey hammered Noah's closed door with a fist while fumbling to dial Ronan's number with his other hand. It rang twice before Ronan's voicemail said merely, Ronan Lynch. Gansey cut off the recorded voice mid-word, his pulse tripping. For a long moment he debated, and then he dialed another number. This time it was Adam's voice that answered, low with sleep and caution. Gansey? Ronan's gone. Adam was quiet. It was not just that Ronan had vanished. It was that he had vanished after a fight with Declan. But it wasn't an easy thing to leave the parish household in the middle of the night. The consequences of getting caught could leave physical evidence, and it was getting too warm for long sleeves. Gansey felt wretched for asking this of him. Outside, a midnight bird cried high and piercing.
The little replica of Henrietta was eerie in the half-light, the die-cast cars parked on the streets appearing as though they had just paused. Gansey always thought that after dark, it felt like anything could happen. At night, Henrietta felt like magic, and at night, magic felt like it might be a terrible thing. "I'll check the park," Adam whispered finally, "and, the bridge, I guess." Adam hung up so softly that it took Gansey a moment to realize the connection had ended. He pressed his fingertips to his eyes, which was how Noah found him. "You're going to look for him?" Noah asked. He looked pale and insubstantial in the yellow late-night light of the room behind him. The skin beneath his eyes was darker than anything. He looked less like Noah than the suggestion of Noah. "Check the church." Noah didn't say he would go along, and Gansey didn't ask him to. 6 months ago, the only time it had ever mattered, Noah had found Ronan in an introspective pool of his own blood, and so he was exempt from ever having to look again. Noah hadn't gone with Gansey to the hospital afterward, and Adam had been caught trying to sneak out, so it was only Gansey who'd been with Ronan when they stitched his skin whole again. It had been a long time ago, but also it was no time at all. Sometimes Gansey felt like his life was made up of a dozen hours that he could never forget. Pulling on his jacket, he headed out into the greenish light of the chilly parking lot. The hood of Ronan's BMW was cold, so it hadn't been driven recently. Wherever he'd gone on foot. The church, its spire illuminated by dusky yellow light, was within walking distance. So was Nino's. So was the old bridge, with the fast current rushing away beneath it. He started to walk. His mind was logical, but his traitorous heart stuttered from beat to beat. He wasn't naive. He carried no illusions that he'd ever recover the Ronan Lynch he'd known before Neil died, but he didn't want to lose the Ronan Lynch he had now. Despite the strong moonlight, the entrance to St. Agnes lay in total darkness. Shivering a bit, Gansey put his hand on the great iron ring that pulled open the church door, unsure if it would be unlocked. He'd only been to St. Agnes once on Easter, because Ronan's younger brother Matthew had asked them all to come. He wouldn't have thought of it as a place someone like Ronan would go in the middle of the night, but then again, he wouldn't have pegged Ronan as a churchgoer at all. And yet all of the Lynch brothers went to St. Agnes every Sunday. For an hour, they managed to sit next to one another in a pew, even when they couldn't meet one another's eyes over a restaurant table. Stepping through the black arch of the entrance, Gansey thought, Noah is good at finding things. He hoped that Noah was right about Ronan. The church enveloped Gansey in an incense-scented pocket of air, a rare enough smell that it instantly evoked half a dozen memories of family weddings, funerals, and baptisms, every one of them summer. How strange that a season should be held captive in one breath of trapped air. Ronan. The word was sucked into the empty space. It echoed off the unseeable ceiling far overhead, so it was only his own voice in the end that answered him. The subdued aisle light made peaked shadows of arches. The darkness and uncertainty crushed Gansey's ribs as small as a fist, his breathless lungs reminding him of yet another long-ago summer day, the afternoon he first realized there was such a thing as magic in the world. And there Ronan was, stretched out on one of the shadowed pews, an arm hanging off the edge, the other skewed above his head, his body a darker bit of black in an already black world. He wasn't moving. Gansey thought, not tonight. Please don't let it be tonight. Edging into the pew behind Ronan, he put his hand on the other boy's shoulder, as if he could merely wake him, praying that by assuming it so, it would be true. The shoulder was warm below his hand. He smelled alcohol. "Wake up, dude," he said. The words didn't sound light, though he meant them to. Ronan's shoulder shifted and his face turned. For a brief, unchained moment, Gansey had a sudden thought that he was too late and Ronan was dead after all and that his corpse woke now only because Gansey had commanded it to. But then Ronan's brilliant blue eyes opened and the moment dissipated. Gansey let out a sigh. "You bastard," Ronan said plainly. I couldn't dream. Then taking in Gansey's stricken expression, he added, I promised you it wouldn't happen again. Gansey tried again to keep his voice light but failed. But you're a liar. I think, Ronan replied, that you're mistaking me for my brother. The church was quiet and full around them. It seemed brighter now that Ronan's eyes were open, as if the building had been asleep as well. When I told you I didn't want you getting drunk at Monmouth, I didn't mean I wanted you drunk somewhere else. Ronan, with only a little slurring, replied, Pot calling the kettle black. With dignity, Gansey said, I drink. I do not get drunk. Ronan's eyes dropped to something he held near his chest. What is that? Gansey asked. Next to his chest, Ronan's fingers curled around a dark object. When Gansey reached down to uncurl his grip, he felt something warm and living, a rapid pulse against his fingertips. He snatched his hand away. Christ, said Gansey, trying to make sense of what he'd felt. Is that a bird? Ronan slowly sat up, still holding his cargo close. Another whiff of alcohol-laced breath drifted toward Gansey. Raven. There was a long pause as Ronan regarded his hand. Maybe a crow, but I doubt it. Seriously doubt it. Corvus corax. Even drunk, Ronan knew the Latin name for the common raven. And it was not just a raven Gansey saw. It was a tiny foundling, featherless mouth still a baby's smile, wings still days and nights and days away from flight. He wasn't sure he would want to touch something that looked so easily destroyable. The raven was Glendower's bird. The Raven King, he was called, from a long line of kings associated with the bird. Legend had it that Glendower could speak to ravens and vice versa. It was only one of the reasons why Gansey was here in Henrietta, a town known for its ravens. His skin prickled. Where did it come from? Ronan's fingers were a compassionate cage around the raven's breast. It didn't look real in his hands. I found it. People find pennies, Gansey replied, or car keys, or four-leaf clovers. And ravens, Ronan said. You're just jealous, 'cause... At this point, he had to stop to regroup his beer-sluggish thoughts. You didn't find one, too. The bird had just crapped between Ronan's fingers onto the pew beside him. Holding the fledgling in one hand, Ronan used a church bulletin to scrape the majority of the mess off the wood. He offered the soiled paper to Gansey. The weekly prayer requests were spattered with white. Gansey only took the paper because he didn't trust Ronan to bother finding a place to throw it out. With some distaste, he asked, what if I implement a no-pets policy at the apartment? Well, hell, man, Ronan replied with a savage smile. You can't just throw out Noah like that. It took Gansey a moment to realize that Ronan had made a joke, and by then it was too late to laugh. In any case, he knew he was going to let the bird return with them to Monmouth Manufacturing because he saw the possessive way Ronan held it. Already the raven looked up at him, beak cracked hopefully, dependent. Gansey relented. Come on, we're going back. Get up. As Ronan unsteadily climbed to his feet, the raven hunched down in his hands, becoming all beak and body, no neck. He said, get used to some turbulence, you little bastard. You can't name it that. Her name's Chainsaw, replied Ronan without looking up. Then... Noah, you're creepy as hell back there. In the deep-shadowed entrance of the church, Noah stood silently. For a second, all that seemed to be visible was his pale face, his dark clothing invisible, and his eyes chasms into someplace unknowable. Then he stepped into the light, and he was rumpled and familiar as always. I thought you weren't coming, Gansey said. Noah's gaze traveled past them to the altar, then up to the dark, unseeable ceiling. He said with typical bravery, the apartment was creepy. Freak, Ronan remarked, but Noah seemed unconcerned. Gansey pulled open the door to the sidewalk. No sign of Adam. Guilt for calling him out for a false alarm was beginning to settle in, though he wasn't entirely certain it was a false alarm. Something had happened, even if he wasn't yet sure what. "Where did you say you found that bird again?"
"In my head." Ronan's laugh was a sharp jackal cry.
"Dangerous place," commented Noah.
Ronan stumbled, all his edges blunted by alcohol, and the raven in his hands let out a feeble sound, more percussive than vocal. He replied, "Not for a chainsaw."
Back out in the hard spring night, Gansey tipped his head back. Now that he knew that Ronan was all right, he could see that Henrietta after dark was a beautiful place, a patchwork town embroidered with black tree branches. A raven. Of all the birds for Ronan to turn up with. Gansey didn't believe in coincidences.
10. Welk was not sleeping. Back when he was an Aglinby boy, sleep had come easy, and why shouldn't it have? Like Cherney and the rest of his classmates, he slept 2 or 4 or 6 hours on weekdays, up late, up early, and then performed marathon sleeping sessions on the weekend. And when he did sleep, it was hours of easy, dreamless sleep. No, he knew that was false. Everyone dreamed, only some forgot. Now, however, he rarely closed his eyes for longer than a few hours at a stretch. He rolled in his bed sheets. He sat bolt upright, woken by whispers. He nodded off on his leather couch, the only piece of furniture the government hadn't seized. His sleep patterns and energy seemed dictated by something larger and more powerful than himself, ebbing and flowing like an uneven tide. Attempts to chart it left him frustrated. He seemed more wakeful at the full moon and after thunderstorms, but beyond that, it was difficult to predict. In his mind, he imagined that it was the magnetic pulse of the ley line itself, somehow invited into his body through Cherney's death. Sleep deprivation made his life an imaginary thing, his days a ribbon floating aimlessly in water. It was nearly a full moon, and it had not been long since it rained, so Welk was awake. He sat in a t-shirt and boxers in front of the computer screen, operating the mouse with the unprincipled and dubious productivity of the fatigued. All in a rush, the countless voices invaded his head, whispering and hissing. They sounded like the static that buzzed over phone lines in the vicinity of the ley line, like the wind before a storm front, like the trees themselves conspiring. As always, Welk couldn't pick out any words, and he couldn't understand the conversation. But he did understand one thing. Something strange had just happened in Henrietta, and the voices couldn't stop talking about it. For the first time in years, Welk retrieved his old county maps from his tiny hall closet. He had no table, and the countertop was cluttered with opened packages of microwave lasagna and plates with stale bread crusts on them. So he spread the maps out in the bathroom instead. A spider in the bathtub skidded out of his way when he flattened a map against the surface. "Cherney, you're in a better place than me, I think." But he didn't really believe that. He had no idea what had become of Cherney's soul or spirit or whatever he wanted to call what had been Cherney. But if Welk had been cursed with whispering voices merely by his part in the ritual, Cherney's fate must have been worse. Welk stood back and crossed his arms, studying the dozens of marks and notations he'd made on the maps over the course of his search. Cherney's impossible handwriting, always in red, noted energy levels along the possible path of the ley line. Back then it had been a game, a treasure hunt, a play for glory. Was it true? It didn't matter. It was an expensive exercise in strategy with the East Coast as the playing field. Looking for patterns, Welk had painstakingly drawn circles around areas of interest on one of the topographical maps. A circle around an old copse of ash trees where the energy levels were always high. A circle around a ruined church that wildlife seemed to avoid. A circle around the place Cherney had died. Of course, he had drawn the circle before Cherney had died. The place, a sinister group of oak trees, had been notable because of old words carved into one of the trunks. Latin.
It seemed incomplete, difficult to translate, and Welk's best guess was the second road. The energy levels were promising there, though, if inconsistent. Surely this, then, was on the ley line. Cherney and Welk had returned a half dozen times, taking readings. Next to the circle, there were six different numbers in Cherney's handwriting. Digging in the dirt for possible artifacts, watching overnight for signs of supernatural activity. Welk had constructed his most complicated and sensitive dowsing rod yet. Two metal wires bent at a 90-degree angle and inserted into a metal tube handle so that they could swing freely. They dowsed the area around it, trying to establish for certain the path of the line. But it remained spotty, coming in and out of focus like a distant radio station. The lines needed to be woken, to have their frequencies honed, the volume turned up. Cherney and Welk made plans to attempt the ritual in the oak grove. They weren't quite sure of the process, though. All Welk could find out was that the line loved reciprocity and sacrifice, but that was frustratingly vague. No other information presented itself, so they kept pushing it off over winter break, spring break, end of the school year. Then Welk's mother had called and told Welk that his father had been arrested for unethical business practices and income tax evasion. It turned out the company had been trading with war criminals, a fact his mother knew and Welk had guessed, and the FBI had been watching for years. Overnight, the Welks lost everything. It was in the papers the next day, the catastrophic crash of the Welk family fortune. Both of Welk's girlfriends left him. Well, the second one was technically Cherney, so perhaps that didn't count. The whole thing was all very public. The Virginia playboy, heir to the Welk fortune, suddenly evicted from his Aglenby dorm, relieved of his social life, freed from any hope of his Ivy League future, watching his car being loaded onto a truck and his room emptied of speakers and furniture. The last time Welk had looked at this map had been as he stood in his dorm room, realizing that the only thing he had left was the $10 bill in his pocket. None of his credit cards meant anything anymore. Cherney had pulled up in his red Mustang. He hadn't gotten out of the car. "Does this make you white trash now?" he'd asked. Cherney didn't really have a sense of humor. He just sometimes said things that happened to be funny. Welk, standing in the wreckage of his life, didn't laugh this time. The ley line wasn't a game anymore. "Unlock your door," Welk had told him. "We're doing the ritual." 11. 1 hour and 23 minutes before Blue's alarm was supposed to go off for school, she was woken by the front door closing. Gray dawn light filtered in her bedroom window, making diffuse shadows of the leaves pressed against the glass. She tried not to resent her lost 1 hour and 23 minutes of sleep. Footsteps started up the staircase. Blue caught the sound of her mother's voice. "Was up waiting for you. Some things are better done at night." This was Neve. Though her voice was smaller than Mora's, it was crisper somehow and carried well. "Henrietta is quite a place, isn't it?"
"I didn't ask you to look at Henrietta,"
Mora replied in a stage whisper. She sounded protective. "It is difficult not to. It shouts," Neve said. Her next words were lost in the sound of a creaking stair. Mora's reply was obscured as she too started to climb the stairs, but it sounded like, "I would prefer if you left Blue out of this." Blue went very still. Neve said, "I'm only telling you what I'm finding. If he vanished at the same time that possible they're linked, do you not want her to know who he is?" Another stair groaned, Blue thought. "Why can't they talk without creaking up the stairs at the same time?" Mora snapped, "I don't see how that would be easier for anyone." Neve murmured a reply. "This is already getting out of hand," her mother said. "It was barely more than typing his name into a search engine, and now..." Blue strained her ears. It felt like she hadn't heard her mother use a masculine pronoun for quite a long time, with the exception of Gansey. It was possible, Blue thought after a long moment, that Mora meant Blue's father. None of the awkward conversations Blue had attempted with her mother had ever gotten her any information about him, just nonsensical, humorous replies. He is Santa Claus. He was a bank robber. He's currently in orbit that changed every time she asked. In Blue's head, he was a dashing, heroic figure who'd had to vanish because of a tragic past, possibly to a witness protection program. She liked to imagine him stealing a glimpse of her over the backyard fence, proudly watching his strange daughter daydream under the beech tree. Blue was awfully fond of her father, considering she'd never met him. Somewhere in the depths of the house, a door closed, and then there was once more the sort of night silence that is hard to disturb. After a long moment, Blue reached over to the plastic bin that served as her nightstand and retrieved the journal. She rested a hand on the cool leather cover. The surface of it felt like the cool, smooth bark of the beech tree behind the house. As when she touched the beech tree, she felt at once comforted and anxious, reassured and driven to action. "Henrietta is quite a place," Neve had said. The journal seemed to agree. A place for what, she wasn't sure. Blue didn't mean to fall asleep, but she did for another hour and 12 minutes. It wasn't her alarm that woke her this time either. It was a single thought shouted in her brain. Today is the day Gansey comes for his reading. Embroiled in the daily routine of getting ready for school, the conversation between Maura and Neve seemed more commonplace than it had before. But the journal was still as magical. Sitting on the edge of her bed, Blue touched one of the quotes. "The king sleeps still under a mountain, and around him is assembled his warriors and his herds and his riches. By his right hand is his cup, filled with possibility. On his breast nestles his sword, waiting too to wake. Fortunate is the soul who finds the king and is brave enough to call him to wakefulness, for the king will grant him a favor, as wondrous as can be imagined by a mortal man." She closed the pages. It felt as if there were a larger, terribly curious Blue inside her that was about to bust out of the smaller, more sensible Blue that held her. For a long moment, she let the journal rest on her legs, the cover cool against her palms. A favor. If she had a favor, what would she ask? To not have to worry about money? To know who her father had been? To travel the world? To see what her mother saw? The thought rang through her brain again. Today is the day Gansey comes for his reading. What will he be like? Maybe if she was standing before that sleeping king, she'd ask the king to save Gansey's life. "Blue, I hope you're awake!" Orla screamed from downstairs. Blue needed to leave soon if she was to make the bike trip to school on time. In a few weeks it would be an uncomfortably hot ride. Possibly she would ask a sleeping king for a car. "I wish I could just cut class today." It wasn't that Blue dreaded high school. It just felt like a holding pattern. And it wasn't as if she was bullied. It hadn't taken her very long to discover that the weirder she looked on the outside, the more she let other kids realize that she wasn't like them from the very beginning, the less likely she was to be picked on or ignored. The fact was, by the time she got to high school, being weird and proud of it was an asset. Suddenly cool, Blue could have happily had any number of friends. And she had tried. But the problem with being weird was that everyone else was normal. So her family remained her closest friends. School remained a chore. And Blue remained secretly hopeful that somewhere out there in the world, there were other odd people like her. Even if they didn't seem to be in Henrietta. It was possible, she thought, that Adam was also odd. "Blue!" Orla bellowed again. "School!" With the journal held fast to her chest, Blue headed toward the red-painted door at the end of the hall. On her way, she had to pass the frenzy of activity in the phone, sewing cat room, and the furious battle for the bathroom. The room behind the red door belonged to Persephone, one of Mora's two best friends. The door was ajar, but still. Blue knocked softly. Persephone was a poor but energetic sleeper. Her midnight shouting and nocturnal leg paddling ensured that she never had to share a room. It also meant that she grabbed sleep when she could. Blue didn't want to wake her.
Persephone's tiny, breathy voice said, "It's available. I mean, open."
Pushing open the door, Blue found Persephone sitting at the card table beside the window. When pressed, people often remembered Persephone's hair, a long, wavy, white, blonde mane that fell to the back of her thighs. If they got past her hair, they sometimes recalled her dresses, elaborate, frothy creations, or quizzical smocks. And if they made it past that, they were unsettled by her eyes, true mirror black, the pupils hidden in the darkness. Currently, Persephone held a pencil with a strangely childlike grip. When she saw Blue, she frowned in a pointy sort of way.
"Good morning," Blue said.
"Good morning," Persephone echoed. "It's too early. My words aren't working, so I'll just use as many of the ones that work for you as possible."
She twirled a hand around in a vague sort of way. Blue took this as a sign to find a place to sit. Most of the bed was covered by strange embroidered leggings and plaid tights running in place, but she found a place to lean her butt on the edge. The whole room smelled familiar, like oranges or baby powder, or maybe like a new textbook. "Sleep badly?" Blue asked.
"Badly," Persephone echoed again. Then, "Oh, well, that's not quite true. I'll have to use my own words after all."
"What are you working on?"
Often Persephone was working on her eternal PhD thesis, but because it was a process that seemed to require vexed music and frequent snacks, she rarely did it during the morning rush.
"Just a little something,"
Persephone said sadly, or perhaps thoughtfully. It was hard to tell the difference, and Blue didn't like to ask. Persephone had a lover or a husband who was dead or overseas. It was always difficult to know details when it came to Persephone, and she seemed to miss him, or at least to notice that he was gone, which was notable for Persephone. Again, Blue didn't like to ask. From Mora, Blue had inherited a dislike of watching people cry, so she never liked to steer the conversation in a way that might result in tears. Persephone tilted her paper up so Blue could see it. She'd just written the word three times, in three different handwritings, and a few inches beneath it, she'd copied a recipe for banana cream pie. "Important things come in threes," Blue suggested. It was one of Mora's favorite sayings. Persephone underlined tablespoon next to the word vanilla in the recipe. Her voice was far away and vague.
"Or sevens. That is a lot of vanilla. One wonders if that is a typo."
"One wonders," repeated Blue.
"Blue!" Mora shouted up. "Are you gone yet?"
Blue didn't reply because Persephone disliked high-pitched sounds and shouting back seemed to qualify as one. Instead, she said, "I found something. If I show it to you, will you not tell anybody else about it?" But this was a silly question. Persephone barely told anybody anything even when it wasn't a secret. When Blue handed over the journal, Persephone asked,
"Should I open it?"
Blue flapped a hand. Yes, and quickly. She fidgeted back and forth on the bed while Persephone paged through, her face betraying nothing. Finally, Blue asked, "Well?"
"It's very nice,"
Persephone said politely. "It's not mine."
"Well, I can see that."
"It was left behind at Ne- Wait, why do you say that?" Persephone paged back and forth. Her dainty child's voice was soft enough that Blue had to hold her breath to hear it.
"This is clearly a boy's journal. Also, it's taking him forever to find this thing. You'd have already found it."
"Blue!" roared Mora. "I'm not shouting again!"
"What do you think I should do about it?" Blue asked. As Blue had, Persephone ran her fingers over the varying grains of the papers.
She realized Persephone was right. If the journal had been hers, she would have just copied down the information she needed rather than all this cutting and pasting. The fragments were intriguing but unnecessary. Whoever put that journal together must love the hunt itself, the process of research. The aesthetic properties of the journal couldn't be accidental. It was an academic piece of art.
Well, Persephone said, first you might find out whose journal it is.
Blue's shoulder sagged. It was a relentlessly proper answer, and one that she might have expected from Mora or Calla. Of course, she knew she had to return it to its rightful owner. But then, where would the fun of it go? Persephone added,
then, I think you'd better find out if it's true, don't you?
12. Adam wasn't waiting by the bank of mailboxes in the morning. The first time that Gansey had come to pick up Adam, he'd driven past the entrance to Adam's neighborhood. Actually, more properly, he'd used it as a place to turn around and head back the way he'd come. The road was two ruts through a field. Even driveway was too lofty a word for it, and it was impossible to believe at first look that it led to a single house, much less a collection of them. Once Gansey had found the house, things had gone even more poorly. At the sight of Gansey's Aglimby sweater, Adam's father had charged out, firing on all cylinders. For weeks after that, Ronan had called Gansey the SRF, where the S stood for soft, the R stood for rich, and the F for something else. Now Adam just met Gansey where the asphalt ended. But there was no one waiting by the clustered herd of mailboxes now. It was just empty space and a lot of it. This part of the valley was endlessly flat in comparison to the other side of Henrietta. And somehow, this field was always several degrees drier and more colorless than the rest of the valley, like both the major roads and the rain avoided it. Even at 8 a.m, there were no shadows anywhere in the world. Peering down the desiccated drive, Gansey tried the house phone, but it merely rang. His watch said he had 18 minutes to make the 15-minute drive to school. He waited. The engine threw the car to and fro as the pig idled. He watched the gear shift knob rattle. His feet were roasting from proximity to the V8. The entire cabin was beginning to stink of gasoline. He called Monmouth Manufacturing. Noah answered, sounding like he'd been woken. Noah, Gansey said loudly to be heard over the engine. Noah had let him leave his journal behind at Nino's after all, and its absence was surprisingly unsettling. Do you remember Adam saying he had work after school today? On the days that Adam had work, he often rode his bike in so that he'd have it to get to places later. Noah grunted to the negative. 16 minutes until class. Call me if he calls, Gansey said.
I won't be here, Noah replied. I'm almost gone anyway.
Gansey hung up and unsuccessfully tried the house again. Adam's mother might be there but not answering, but he didn't really have time to go back into the neighborhood and investigate. He could cut class. Gansey tossed the phone onto the passenger seat. Come on, Adam. Of all the places Gansey had attended boarding school, and he'd attended many in his 4 years of underage wandering, Aglimby Academy was his father's favorite, which meant it was the most likely to land its student body in the Ivy League, or the Senate. It also meant, however, that it was the most difficult school Gansey had ever been to. Before Henrietta, he'd made his search for Glendower his primary activity, and school had been a distant second. Gansey was clever enough, and he was good at studying, if nothing else, so it hadn't been a problem to skip classes or push homework to the bottom of the list. But at Aglimby, there were no failing grades. If you dropped below a B average, you were out on your ass. And Dick Gansey II had let his son know that if he couldn't hack it in a private school, Gansey was cut out of the will. He'd said it nicely, though, over a plate of fettuccine. Gansey couldn't cut class, not after missing school the day before. That was what it came down to. 14 minutes to make a 15-minute drive to school, and Adam not waiting. He felt the old fear creeping slowly out of his lungs. Don't panic. You were wrong about Ronan last night.
You have to stop this. Death isn't as close as you think.
Dispirited, Gansey tried the home phone one more time. Nothing. He had to go. Adam must have taken his bike. He must have had work. He must have had errands to run and forgotten to tell him. The rutted drive down to the neighborhood was still empty. Come on, Adam. Wiping his palms on his slacks, he put his hands back on the steering wheel and headed for the school.
Gansey didn't get a chance to see if Adam had made it to Aglenby until third period when they both had Latin. This was inexplicably the only class Ronan never missed. Ronan was head of class in Latin. He studied joylessly but relentlessly, as if his life depended on it. Directly behind him was Adam, Aglenby's star pupil, otherwise at the top of every class that he took. Like Ronan, Adam studied relentlessly because his future life did depend on it. For his part, Gansey preferred French. He told Helen there was very little purpose to a language that couldn't be used to translate a menu, but really, French was just easier for him to learn. His mother spoke a little. He'd originally resigned himself to taking Latin in order to translate historical texts for Glendower research, but Ronan's proficiency at the language robbed Gansey's study of any urgency. Latin was held in Borden House, a small frame house on the other side of the Aglenby campus from Welsh Hall, the main academic building. As Gansey strode hurriedly across the center green, Ronan appeared, knocking Gansey's arm. His eyes looked like he hadn't slept in days. Ronan hissed, "Where's Parrish?"
"He didn't come in with me today," Gansey said, mood sinking. Ronan and Adam shared second period.
"You haven't seen him yet?"
"Wasn't in class."
Behind Gansey, someone punched his shoulder blade and said, "Gansey boy!" as they trotted by. Gansey half-heartedly lifted three fingers, the signal of the rowing team.
"I tried calling him at the house," he said.
Ronan replied, "Well, poor boy needs a cell."
A few months earlier, Gansey had offered to buy Adam a cell phone, and by so doing had launched the longest fight they'd ever had, a week of silence that had resolved itself only when Ronan did something more offensive than either of them could accomplish.
"Lynch!"
Gansey looked in the direction of the voice. Ronan didn't. The owner of the voice was halfway across the green, difficult to identify in the homogeneous Aglenby uniform.
"Lynch!" the call came again. "I'm going to fuck you up!"
Ronan still didn't look up. He adjusted the strap on his shoulder and continued stalking across the grass.
"What's that about?" Gansey demanded.
"Some people don't take losing very well," Ronan replied.
"Was that Kavinsky? Don't tell me you've been racing again."
"Don't ask me then."
Gansey contemplated if he could give Ronan a curfew, or if he should quit rowing to spend more time with him on Fridays. He knew that was when Ronan got into trouble with the BMW.
Maybe he could convince Ronan to...
Ronan adjusted the strap on his shoulder again, and this time Gansey took a closer look at it. The bag it belonged to was distinctly larger than his usual, and he handled it gingerly as if it might spill. Gansey asked, "Why are you carrying that bag?"
"Oh, my God. You have that bird in there, don't you?" "She has to be fed every 2 hours."
"How do you know?"
"Jesus, the internet, Gansey."
Ronan pulled open the door to Borden House. As soon as they breached the threshold, everything within sight was covered with navy blue carpet.
"If you get caught with that thing..." But Gansey couldn't think of a suitable threat.
What was the punishment for smuggling a live bird into classes? He wasn't certain there was precedent. He finished instead, "If it dies in your bag, I forbid you to throw it out in a classroom."
"She," Ronan corrected. "It's a she."
"I'd buy that if it had any defining sexual characteristics. It had better not have bird flu or something." But he wasn't thinking about Ronan's raven. He was thinking about Adam not being in class. Ronan and Gansey took their usual seats in the back of the navy-carpeted classroom. At the front of the room, Welk was writing verbs on the board. When Gansey and Ronan had come in, Welk had stopped writing mid-word, "internec." Though there was no reason to think Welk cared about their conversation, Gansey had the strange idea that the lifted piece of chalk in Welk's hand was because of them, that the Latin teacher had stopped writing merely to listen in.
Adam's suspicion really was beginning to rub off on him. Ronan caught Welk's eye and held it in an unfriendly sort of way. Despite his interest in Latin, Ronan had declared their Latin teacher a socially awkward shitbird earlier in the year and further clarified that he didn't like him. Because he despised everyone, Ronan wasn't a good judge of character, but Gansey had to agree that there was something discomforting about Welk. A few times Gansey had tried to hold a conversation with him about Roman history, knowing full well the effect an enthusiastic academic conversation could have on an otherwise listless grade. But Welk was too young to be a mentor, and too old to be a peer, and Gansey couldn't find an angle. Ronan kept staring at Welk. He was good at staring. There was something about his stare that took something from the other person. The Latin teacher flicked his glance awkwardly away from them. Having dealt with Welk's curiosity, Ronan asked, "What are you going to do about Parrish?" "I guess I'm going to go by there after class, right?" "He's probably sick." They looked at each other. "We're already making excuses for him," Gansey thought. Ronan peered inside his bag again. In the darkness, Gansey just caught a glimpse of the raven's beak. Usually, Gansey would have basked once more in the odds of Ronan finding a raven, but at the moment, with Adam missing, his quest didn't feel like magic. It felt like years spent piecing together coincidences, and all he had made from it was a strange cloth, too heavy to carry, too light to do any good at all.
"Mr. Gansey, Mr. Lynch..."
Welk had managed to suddenly manifest beside their desks. Both boys looked up at him. Gansey polite, Ronan hostile.
"You seem to have an extremely large bag today, Mr. Lynch," Welk said.
"You know what they say about men with large bags," Ronan replied. "Ostendes tuum et ostendam meus."
Gansey had no idea what Ronan had just said, but he was certain from Ronan's smirk that it wasn't entirely polite. Welk's expression confirmed Gansey's suspicion, but he merely rapped on Ronan's desk with his knuckles and moved off. "Being a shit in Latin isn't the way to an A," Gansey said. Ronan's smile was golden.
"It was last year."
At the front of the room, Welk began class. Adam never showed. 13.
"Mom, why is Neve here?" Blue asked. Like her mother, she was standing on the kitchen table. The moment she'd come back from school, Maura had enlisted her help for changing the bulbs and the badly designed stained glass creation that hung over the table. The complicated process required at least 3 hands and tended to be left until most of the bulbs had burned out. Blue hadn't minded helping. She needed something to keep her mind off Gansey's looming appointment and off Adam's failure to call. When she thought about giving him her number the night before, she felt weightless and uncertain.
"She's family," Maura replied grimly.
She savagely gripped the fixture's chain as she wrestled with a stubborn bulb.
"Family that comes home in the middle of the night?" Maura shot Blue a dark look.
"You were born with larger ears than I remember. She's just helping me look for something while she's here."
The front door opened. Neither of them thought anything of it, as both Calla and Persephone were about the house somewhere. Calla was less likely, as she was an irascible, sedentary creature of habit. But Persephone tended to get caught in odd drafts and blow around. Adjusting her grip on the stained glass, Blue asked, "What sort of something?"
"Blue,
what sort of something?"
"A someone," Maura said finally.
"What sort of someone?" But before her mother had time to reply, they heard a man's voice.
"That is a strange way to run a business."
They both turned slowly. Blue's arms had been lifted for so long they felt rubbery when she lowered them. The owner of the voice stood in the doorway to the front hall, his hands in his pockets. He was not old, maybe mid-20s with a shock of black hair. He was handsome in a way that required a bit of work from the viewer. All of his facial features seemed just a little too large for his face. Maura glanced at Blue, an eyebrow lifted. Blue lifted one shoulder in response. He didn't seem like he was here to murder them or steal any portable electronics. "And that,"
her mother said, releasing the beleaguered light fixture, is a very strange way to enter someone's home.
I'm sorry, the young man said. There is a sign out front saying this is a place of business.
There was indeed a sign out front, hand-painted, though Blue didn't know by whose hand, that read, Psychic. And beneath that, By appointment only, Mora told the man. She grimaced into the kitchen. Blue had left a basket of clean laundry by the kitchen counter, and one of her mother's mauve lacy bras sat on top in full view. Blue refused to feel guilty. It wasn't as if she had expected men to be wandering through the kitchen. The man said,
Well then, I'd like to make an appointment.
A voice from the doorway to the stairs made all three of them turn.
We could do a triple reading for you,
Persephone said. She stood at the base of the stairs, small and pale and made largely of hair. The man stared at her, though Blue wasn't certain if this was because he was considering Persephone's proposal or because Persephone was quite a lot to take in at first glance.
What, the man asked finally, is that?
It took Blue a moment to realize that he meant triple reading rather than Persephone. Mora jumped off the table, landing with enough force that the glasses in the cabinet rattled. Blue climbed down more respectfully. She was, after all, holding a box of light bulbs. Mora explained, It's when three of us, Persephone, Calla, and I, read your cards at the same time and compare our interpretations. She doesn't offer that to just anyone, you know.
Is it more expensive?
Not if you change that one stubborn bulb, Mora said, wiping her hands off on her jeans.
Fine, said the man.
But he sounded vexed about it. Mora gestured for Blue to give a light bulb to the man, and then she said, Persephone, would you get Calla?
Oh, dear,
Persephone said in a small voice, and Persephone's voice was already quite small, so her small voice was indeed tiny, but she turned and went up the stairs. Her bare feet were soundless as she did. Mora eyed Blue, asking a question with her expression. Blue shrugged in agreement. My daughter, Blue, will be in the room, if you don't mind. She makes the reading more clear. With a disinterested glance at Blue, the man climbed onto the table, which creaked a bit under the weight. He grunted as he tried to twist the stubborn bulb. Now you see the problem, Mora said. What is your name?
Ah, he said, giving the bulb a jerk. Can we leave this anonymous?
Mora said, We're psychics, not strippers. Blue laughed, but the man didn't. She thought this was rather unfair of him. Maybe it was in slightly poor taste, but it was funny. The kitchen abruptly lightened as the new bulb screwed into place. Without comment, he stepped onto a chair and then to the floor. We'll be discreet, Mora promised. She gestured for him to follow her. In the reading room, the man looked around with clinical interest. His gaze passed over the candles, the potted plants, the incense burners, the elaborate dining room chandelier, the rustic table that dominated the room, the lace curtains, and finally landed on a framed photograph of Steve Martin. Signed, Mora said with some pride, noticing his attention. Then, Ah, Calla. Calla blew into the room, her eyebrows quite angry at being disturbed. She was wearing lipstick in a dangerous shade of plum, which made her mouth a small pursed diamond under her pointy nose. Calla gave the man a lacerating look that plumbed the depths of his soul and found it wanting. Then she plucked her deck of cards from a shelf by Mora's head and flopped into a chair at the end of the table. Behind her, Persephone stood in the doorway, her hands clasping and unclasping each other. Blue slid hastily into a chair at the end of the table. The room seemed a lot smaller than it had a few minutes before. This was mostly Calla's fault. Persephone said in a kind voice,
Have a seat.
And Calla said in an unkind one, What is it you want to know? The man dropped into a seat. Mora took the chair opposite from him at the table, with Calla and Persephone, and Persephone's hair, on either side of her. Blue was, as always, just a little apart.
I would rather not say, the man said. Maybe you'll tell me.
Calla's plum smile was positively fiendish. Maybe. Mora slid her deck of cards across the table to the man and told him to shuffle them. He did so with proficiency and little self-consciousness. When he was done, Persephone and Calla did the same. "You've been to a reading before," Mora noted. He made only a vaguely grumbling noise of assent. Blue could see he thought that any information would let them fake the reading. Still, she didn't think he was a skeptic. He was merely skeptical of them. Mora slid her deck back from the man. She'd had her deck for as long as Blue had been paying attention, and the edges were fuzzy with handling. They were a standard tarot deck, only as impressive as she made them. She selected 10 cards and laid them out. Calla did the same with her slightly crisper deck. She'd replaced them a few years ago after an unfortunate incident had made her lose her taste for her previous deck. The room was quiet enough to hear the rustle of their cards against the uneven, pocked surface of the reading table. Persephone held her cards in her long, long hands, eyeing the man for a pregnant moment. Finally, she contributed only 2 cards, one at the beginning of the spread and one at the end. Blue loved watching Persephone lay down her cards. The limpid turn of a wrist and the swick of the card always made it seem like a sleight of hand or a ballet movement. Even the cards themselves seemed more otherworldly. Persephone's cards were slightly larger than Mora's and Calla's, and the art on them was curious. Spidery lines and smudgy backgrounds suggested the figures on each card. Blue had never seen another deck like it. Mora had told Blue once that it was hard to ask Persephone questions that she didn't absolutely need the answer to, so Blue had never found out where the deck had come from. Now that the cards were laid out, Mora, Calla, and Persephone studied the shape of them. Blue struggled to see over their huddled heads. She tried to ignore that, this close to the man, he had the overpowering chemical scent of a manly shower gel. The sort that normally came in a black bottle and was called something like shock or